time for a which is the number one chocolate
drink. Two pizzas for the price of one.
A taste so wonderful.
That's a spicy meat.
Pathogens are in some ways something of a mirror of our civilization. The notion that a pathogen might emerge and kill a billion people is no sweat, really. I mean, that's the great terror of this.
Thanks for joining us for The Secret Ingredient, a podcast produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas, that takes you into the depths of food history and production. We won't tell you what to eat, but we can tell you why you're eating it. For KUT, I'm Rebecca McEnroy.
And I'm Tom Philpott, food and agriculture writer for Mother Jones Magazine.
And I'm Raj Patel from the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs.
This week's secret ingredient is pathogens. One of the ways that we produce food in the United States and globally now is by amassing thousands and thousands of animals in close quarters. And when you do that, you are going to create a beautiful habitat for all kinds of bacteria and viruses that want to live in them. And some of those things end up being things that make us sick, which are known as pathogens. And this week we have Rob Wallace on the show. Rob is an evolutionary biologist and public health phylogeographer, presently visiting at the Institute of Global Studies at the University of Minnesota. And he's been writing a blog for years that I've read faithfully called Farming Pathogens, which you can find on WordPress. And he's just out with a new book, Big Farms Make Big Flu, Dispatches on Infectious Disease, Agribusiness, and the Nature of Science. Welcome to the show, Rob.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Rob, you know, your topic really sort of came to the fore last year. There was this major outbreak starting in the Northwest and then moving into Midwestern egg and poultry production of a highly pathogenic strain of avian flu. And I guess it made headlines a little bit because it caused egg prices to go up a little bit and maybe poultry prices as well. But in that part of the country, it's more of an egg production. I'm wondering if you can talk us through exactly what happened and what the response was from the federal government.
Yeah, sure. The influenza strain is H5N2, and H is referring to hemagglutinin, and N refers to neuraminidase, and those are proteins on the surface of the influenza that allow the virus to get into the cells that they target and to get out of them. And so there are a whole bunch of them, and they are able to recombine in different ways. And so this combination, H5N2, and there are also all sorts of other internal influenza genes in there as well, but we'll leave them aside for now. So this strain apparently made its way across the Bering Strait, probably brought in by some migratory birds. And from there, they started to spill over in the Northwest into some smallholder farms and But at that point, it wasn't really problematic. But somehow, some way, and they're not really quite sure how, it made its way into Minnesota and started to hit a lot of the turkey barns here. And so, despite the fact that it did eventually get into chickens and devastated the much of the egg production in northern Iowa, here in Minnesota, it's the turkey industry that's the big deal. I mean, it's we're the number one producers of turkey in the country.
Right.
And, I mean, it just went in there and you got to understand what pathogens can do. I mean, this is this influenza. I mean, typically, you know, you get the flu and it feels bad and you feel terrible. But, I mean, when birds are hit by a really pathogenic one, a really deadly one, they basically bleed out of all their orifices. I mean, it's basically it's kind of dramatic on my part, but it's kind of Ebola with wings, basically. I mean,
right.
And so you would have turkey barns in which every single bird of, let's say, 22,000 birds in a barn was killed by the virus. And subsequently, the virus spread, and they weren't quite sure how, and they ended up figuring out that it was spreading by a number of modes of transmission, including in the air on what are called fomites or little particles, and also by trucks. So if you produce your poultry and you ship it into the processor, then the virus is on the move as much as the birds are. And so starting in a few outlying counties in Minnesota, it began to spread all over across Minnesota, hitting all these farms. And the key thing here to understand is that the turkey industry here understood this right from the start, that they were in crisis mode. And so they had to increase their biosecurity, meaning making sure that workers were properly clothed, and making sure to wash your boots on the way in and out. And despite all these attempts to make sure that the pathogen didn't spread, it spread anyway. In some sense, the virus had cracked the code on this particular industrial model. And what's fascinating about the way industry handled it, well, it's a couple things. One, they were in complete denial. They pretended that this was not happening, that this doesn't happen, that this only happens in places like China, and that it doesn't happen here, despite the fact that it's happening elsewhere and around the world, in part because countries are now taking on the model of agricultural production that the United States first introduced earlier in the 20th century. So why is it happening? How has it come about? And in part, well, just to go back, the industry tried to blame it as in sort of an Asian flu, which is a, you know, like it gets back into the core of a kind of Sinophobia, kind of a fear of the East that is deep embedded into the kind of the cultural history of the country, to blame foreign lands for being the source of our diseases. So like Spanish influenza, you know, like so on and so forth. But the thing is that influenzas have been crossing the Bering Strait and going across intercontinental distances for thousands of years. And so this shouldn't be a surprise that something like this might happen. I mean, the key is, well, how is it that this pathogen was able to do so well in these barns? And the industry did everything it could to kind of detract attention from the source of why it works, why the pathogen did so well in these barns. And so they would blame Asia, they would blame the wild birds, they would blame the farmers, they would blame everybody except the industrial model.
Right.
And what's really amazing about this outbreak is that, you know, usually the outbreaks are kind of messy. Like you'll have, let's say, particularly in China or Thailand or in Indonesia, you'll have a large barn hit, but then it'll spill over into the smallholders nearby. And so there's always a competition between who people pointing fingers and who's to blame and such. And it's a mixed bag. I mean, sometimes this division even between industrial poultry and smallholders is not always the same or clear because large companies will contract out the raising of their chickens or their turkey to smallholders. And when the birds are the right size, the smallholders will bring them back to be processed. So it's not always clear, the, you know, large production and small producers. But in this case, I mean, it was really amazing that almost there wasn't a single smallholder here in Minnesota that was hit. And every outbreak, every barn hit was part of a large industrial farm.
Yeah, I did a piece on that in the middle of the outbreak, that it did not seem to be spreading to backyard flocks. And right. You know, and I remember at the time there was a major effort by the USDA and the industry to suggest that it was somehow wild birds spreading it within the Midwest, so from farm to farm. And that explanation never made any sense. And then later it became clear that, as you say, it was about the industrial model. It was the trucks. It was possibly feed somehow being infected by it. But it was the way that the model is so tightly integrated between the farms and the processors and these trucks that move back and forth. And in a situation like that, it's just really hard to keep everything clean.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're shipping in from one barn to the next 15,000 turkey or even 250,000 chickens. I mean, you're not going to be able to keep track of every virion, every bird. In fact, it's kind of an epiphenomenon. It's the emergent property of having all these birds together. That's the key aspect. And I mean, what is the mechanism by which a pathogen would enter a barn and do so well? I mean, the thing is, if you can think of a industrial, or you can think of a way of raising poultry that would be the best way to produce a virulent influenza, for instance, it's the way we have it now that you would do it. So you've got 15,000 birds, or in the case of chickens, 250,000 birds packed in the same barn or series of barns nearby. And they're all genetically the same. So there's no immune firebreak, meaning there is no immune diversity in such a way that the virus might do well in one bird, but it won't do well in the next. So the virus moves in, and if it can crack one bird, it's cracked the rest of the barn or the rest of the farm, or indeed the rest of the sector across the state, because they're all the same, and almost all the birds are bred out of two or three companies. So they're genetically, as the various sectors of the industry consolidate, let's say the egg production consolidates to a few companies, then also the number of genetic lines that are produced are also consolidated. If you are have all this genetic monoculture within a barn, and then the virus gets in, then if it cracks one bird, as I was saying, it can crack the rest of the barn. It can easily spread, and you know, the company companies are angling for what are called economies of scale. If I can learn how to produce a lot of this together, then I won't have to produce put in as much money per bird as I would if I was working in a smaller operation.
I just wanted to reel you back for a second, just to this moment of blame storming, where the industry is pointing fingers at almost everything except itself. And you mentioned China, and I was struck in your book about how the idea of blaming China for things is not new. You know, the strategy of pointing fingers, you know, of blaming everything except the industrial food system isn't novel. And in particular, this term "yellow peril," I understood it to be related to the threat of Chinese communism, but actually it's something else. Can you explain the history of that term? Because it falls squarely in your field, apparently.
Yeah, well, you know, well, this is the thing about, you know, I'm trained as an evolutionary biologist, and then, you know, I try to get a handle on how these pathogens evolve. I've initially started looking at genetic sequences of H5N1 in China, and then, you know, figured out that it was a particular province in China, Guangdong, that was the source of H5N1 back in the early part of the century. At some point, though, I got curious, which can be a problem for one's career. But I got curious, like, well, why did this particular strain emerge in Guangdong in 1997? And so I got interested in the notion of, what is the economic geography of agriculture in the region? And so, you know, once you're actually interested in trying to find out the answers to questions rather than merely clocking in one grant after the other, then it gets you, it loosens you off into all sorts of territory. And so I'm by no means an expert in economic geography. I'm not I don't know everything about the cultural history of pejorative terms for diseases for peoples around the world. But I have found it that it's absolutely necessary to try to make the best attempt as one can to kind of integrate all those things to try to explain how diseases operate, because pathogens are in some way something of a mirror of our civilization, and certainly they have their own agency, and they've been around before humanity emerged. But in addition, they respond to our civilization and the opportunities and barriers that we present. And so when a pathogen emerges, it tells us something about the nature of our civilization and who we are. And so, when a pathogen does so well, as in the H5N2 that we were all just talking about, it tells us something about how we produce food in this country and, what our weak links are. And all the way down to these broader issues of these cultural prejudices and so, you know, the notion of yellow peril, of course, as I understand it, at least in this country, began when many of the Chinese began to migrate over a couple centuries ago into California and such. And there was a concern, as there is now, the nativist fear of people from other places being able to blame them for things that they may have actually nothing to do with. But in doing so, we are able to protect our particular prime directives around which society is organized. Mm-hmm. And so And of course, the notions of yellow peril actually go back even centuries before. There were various plagues. The actual plague, bubonic plague, emerged out of China as well, and it spread around the world. And so there's this fear of foreign places as being sources of pathogens. Never mind, of course, that you know, many of the pathogens that have emerged recently, and this is something that is something of a surprise for people here in the United States, is that we are also a source of many pathogens. And H1N1 in 2009 emerged in Mexico, but the pathogens that fed into that outbreak evolved here in the United States in the hog industry. So, and that's it's a weird balance, because on the one hand, and I think you'll see, Raj, and if you remember, it's like I have a I changed my mind over the course of the book. I mean, these are essays, so starting 2007, and then even though in the first essay I drew the best I can to try to kind of rebound or block against the kind of Sinophobic notion that China is the only one to blame. But I'm actually quite hard on the Chinese in terms of the local governments and the central government in terms of how they handle outbreaks like SARS and H5N1 and how they dealt with it. And indeed, there's a long history that goes all the way back into even, you know, beginning of the origin of rice and the first domestication of ducks in large flocks a couple hundred years ago, and then this last layer, the use or the assimilation of our model of industrial production. So you have a nice layer cake of that produces a perfect storm of circumstances that allow all sorts of influences to be able to emerge and spread. So China is in many ways an important source of many of these influenzas. However, as I make my way across the book, and in part I actually went to China and talked to people and looked at things, and you realize that it's a lot more complicated than it at first look, and that and then when you begin to see how integrated global agriculture is, and by definition, as a result, also how integrated global epidemiology is, kind of the notion of blame shifts in a way that it's not merely a matter of any one particular country, although each country should take responsibility for its role in how influenza and other pathogens emerge. But in addition, there are these larger processes going on, and that arise out of the nature of how we organize our economies. And this is why, you know, I find it incredibly important that, you know, that my decision to go into kind of looking at the economy of agriculture opened up a whole new world and understanding of how pathogens arise. So in answer to your question, you know, the yellow peril thing is deeply embedded in the history of the country and even very much the history of the world. And it provides a means, a shield, a cultural shield by which the industry here can deflect attention from its role in the emergence of H5N2 and other pathogens.
So Rob, one more question getting back to the H5N2. The whole question of what does it take for one of these flu pathogens to jump species? So we had the 2009 outbreak of swine flu that ended up jumping species, obviously, to humans, but it didn't end up being very virulent. Like the fears about what kind of damage it would cause ended up being rather mild in the scheme of things. And then you get this latest outbreak of bird flu in the Midwest, where it's highly pathogenic to birds and spreads really easily, but, you know, it doesn't jump species. You know, what makes, and is there a difference between swine flu and bird flu? And what are the sort of danger factors there for seeing some of these things jump over?
Right. Well, this is something of the holy grail for a lot of molecular biologists, is to identify the particular amino acid replacement that allows that turns a virus from an influenza virus from one that just hits birds and one that hits humans. And there are a variety of markers that might indicate that. And the problem is that there are many roads that lead to Rome, that there are many molecular roads by which a pathogen or like influenza can turn from something specific to livestock into one that's more for humans. And as you pointed out, that once it goes into humans, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be deadly. Although the H1N1 was actually much more deadly than what was bandied about at the time. The problem is, and I think I've kind of I used to participate in that rush for the Holy Grail. I used to look at the amino acid replacements, and I used to look at the shifts in uracil levels that might indicate that a pathogen, that influenza, might be going from more avian influenza to a more mammalian kind of version of it. And I kind of gave up, and in part because of the many roads leading to Rome, but in part because it misses the picture, which is influenzas and other animal pathogens are always spilling over into humans. It's happening all the time. So it's not, you know, trying to lock down the particular molecular mechanism, while, you know, I appreciate those efforts, are kind of misses the point that it's not so much which one, but how much of an opportunity they have to actually continue to spill over. And if are producing livestock, whether or in poultry, in such a way that many of these pathogens are given ample opportunity to experiment with the transmissibility, with virulence, that at some point they will figure out a means and mechanism by which to do so. And sometimes, you know, a lot of the spillovers that happen, because it's happening every day. Every day, influenza is spilling over to human beings. It could be farm workers. It could be here. It could be in China. It could be a smallholder. It could be at a large farm. It's happening every day, all the time. And most of those don't make it. Some smallholder farmer in Indonesia, immune system clears out, or there's a small little rush that, you know, that the chain of transmission, it gets blocked and doesn't go further than that. But then the goalposts are moved in such a way that all of a sudden we've got one that actually does, you know, human to human, and it's fascinating the way the scientific community and the industry characterize it, because over in my 10-15 years of looking at this stuff, you know, at first it was like, oh, well, we don't have to worry about it because it's only going to go locally in birds in China. And then H5N1 blew its way across China, across Eurasia into Africa. Oh, well, we don't have to worry about it now because it's only hitting birds. And then H1N1 2009 actually spilled over from hog into humans, and it goes around the world and say, oh, you know what? It's not a problem. It's not virulent. And now we're down to the last one, which is a strain that emerges out of hogs or poultry and then spills over into humans, and it's also deadly and also transmissible. And it's as if this hope that bad things won't happen, it's this confusion or this mistake of thinking that history tells us the future, that it allows, and because of the inertia built into political economy that rewards industry for producing meat cheaply and in a way that whatever bad effects that happen, whether it's environmental pollution, whether it's an influenza that comes and kills a billion people, whether it's the prices that are given to the terrible prices that smallholder contract farmers are given. All these things are prices and costs that are externalized to everybody else. So there's no means by which the industry can economically feel the pinch of producing animals in this way. And so that's why it continues to go on. And in essence, we're engaged in a kind of a fantasy that the way that we produce food has nothing to do with the potentiality of a pathogen that kills a billion people. And however, I mean, there's all these signposts along the way that we are deeply involved in a terrible a process. And it used to be that we used to be hit by the H1, H2, H3 outbreaks. And now, with the advent of kind of a globalized production of this industrial model that's spreading all over the world, including to the smallest village you can imagine. I mean, it's the tendrils by which this model is moving around the world is quite shocking. I mean, we're talking about deep into the forests of Africa. I mean, they're doing industrial hog production in the middle of the sub-Saharan, jungle. I mean, it has led to the emergence of influenza serotypes that we had never imagined would spill over into humans. So now we have, all of a sudden, we have H5s and H6s and H7s and H9s that are now spilling over to humans on a regular basis and starting to get... begin to feel their evolutionary way into figuring out the transmissibility going from human to human.
Wow.
I
have a question. So it's interesting to me all the worlds that you are kind of navigating as well. So you owned a deli, right, for a while?
Well, until about a week ago, I was working at a deli.
Yeah, working at a deli.
Yeah.
I mean, working at a deli and also studying molecular biology and these different mm-hmm. pathogens and then, you know, navigating these different worlds. And I was wondering, you know, after writing this book, what metaphors are lingering in your head? And just kind of like, you know, how do you see it kind of like on a metaphorical mm-hmm. level now?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And, I struggle with it. I think part of it is, I remember when I first got, as a postdoc, started working on influenza and, this is out in the University of California, and I started looking at the genetic sequences, I start to grasp the, there's a terrible logic in all this, and it's you feel it. It's an unavoidable thing, the notion that we have these viruses that can have incredible amount of genetic diversity, and they're capacity to explore their evolutionary space and figure out ways by which to move from human to human and turn into a terrible pandemic. And, I mean, in the early days, it was actually quite rough for me to actually grapple with that logic that, it's a kind of a sword of Damocles that, there I think maybe is one of the metaphors that comes up. I mean, it's mm-hmm. as much of a sword of Damocles over us as the climate change mm-hmm. and, the terrible possibility that someday it's going to come down. And I remember being terribly affected by it in the early days of my research, and many an influenza scholar researcher has had to grapple with this. In the book, I actually take to task many researchers for their ties to agribusiness or their refusal to confront various powers that be. But at the same time, I have a great respect and understanding about where they're at. They're under an incredible amount of pressure to grapple with, how do we stop a pandemic from happening in such a way in a world in which does not actually want to do the things necessary to stop it, because there's going to be a lot of money involved, and the political process is such that scientists are run off the road if they were to say anything other than what is necessary to get the next grant.
I
think the first thing that comes.
Right,
oh, yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, there's the question. I mean, why am I working in a deli, right? I mean, at some point I was funded by NIH, and at some point I was getting multiple contracts from the Food and Agriculture Organization studying influenza. I mean, that was when the early days, like 2007, 2008, when the world was actually scared shitless over bird flu. And so the money strings were open, and you were able to. There was actually cash around, and FAO was able to give some money out to researchers. And at that point, when they're the larger civilization is as frightened as it were, then there's an opening actually for other ideas. And then once bird flu has been locked down as a political problem, I mean, it's still a biological problem. It's still out there. In fact, it's much worse than it was even 10 years ago. But it's a political problem. It's been kind of set aside, and other pathogens have kind of emerged as the frightening face of neoliberal epidemiology, like Ebola or in this case Zika. And but influenza continues to be much of a problem. It as a political problem has been digested, as it were, and put aside. And so I found when I came here to Minnesota, I began to talk a lot about these things. And I mean, we're in an agribusiness state, and the University of Minnesota, which has a proud history as a land-grant university helping farmers with their problems, has been cored out. And so now it's, in essence, an agribusiness R&D unit. And many of the professors there and researchers who are quite brilliant are actually, in order to keep their labs floating, basically work for the Minnesota Pork Board or the turkey industry there. And this is how they pay their bills and fund their students. And so all the alternate food landscapes that we might imagine can't be worked on. There's a research gap, our capacity to figure out, well, what if we're not going to do poultry this way because it produces an H5N2, what else could we do? How else do we do it? Because it's perfectly reasonable to continue to produce turkey, maybe, and how would we do it if we were to do it differently? Well, all the money's been dried up. It's gone. So I found myself at some point not being able to pay my bills. So I ended up working at a local deli here, and I was a deli clerk. I made Greek salads and sandwiches and stuff. So, it's quite of a shock, isn't it? Because, you know, I go from, you know, flying around the world helping, you know, talking to various ministries of health and stuff like that to being someone making someone else's sandwich like that. But I will say, though, that, I think it's I learned something. I found something when I decided to follow my curiosity rather than follow merely matter of money. And money is important still. You know, I have an 8-year-old. I got bills to pay. I got mouths to feed. But there is something that I found when I decided to actually look at other ways of move out from underneath the dominant paradigm of looking at pathogens in a particular way and look at the agricultural economy that underlies the shifts that pathogens are undertaking. And, I learned things and I found things and much of the book actually describes and I hope gets the sense of discovery in the course of reading some of the stuff. I mean, the notion pathogens might take advantage of some of the key aspects of industrial production, of the industrial model, and evolve and spread by virtue of that industrial model is quite of a shock to me. Because, you know, as a biologist, you're looking at the genetic sequences, you're looking at proteins, you're looking at, you might look at the ecology of systems, how, let's say, wild birds interact with livestock. But the notion that these pathogens might be evolving, responding to our economies is something that is really not on board, really, right now. And I found answers. I found made discoveries, and it was quite fulfilling to be able to do that. And I find this book was an opportunity to be able to share that with everybody, because there's no sense in going off and figuring out things and not bringing it back and sharing it.
You know, Rob, I've been thinking about this stuff for a long time, and you know, you're bringing up one of the massive risks of industrial agriculture, you know, the obvious jumping over some pathogen that could become virulent and easily transmissible. And it's just one of the many risks that is inherent in the model. And as you said earlier, you know, these are costs that are off put onto society as a whole, not on the shareholders of these companies. And so sometimes I think, you know, why would these companies and why would the government regulators, you know, your sort of USDA, FDA, EPA, why would they sort of prop all of this up, knowing as they must that it contains so much risk? And what I want to ask you is, as someone who also thinks about economics, is the model of food production that we're talking about, is it crucial to make our current economic system go? And what I mean by that is, you know, we're in a period of, you know, decades of stagnation in wages, right? So wages really haven't grown in a sustained way since the 1970s, since the collapse of Keynesianism in the 1970s. And if we're going to have stagnant wages, if that's going to be the sort of basis of your economy, that you sort of have low labor costs and global markets to put, put consumers and to put workers, was what I mean, in competition with each other. Don't you need to have a really cheap and efficient way to produce food? And if it has all of these risks, well, maybe you can just sort of hope to put them out off onto the future and maybe figure out ways to prop it up if it falls down. But is the way that we produce food, is it so endemic to the economic system that it can't be reformed by the economic system?
Well, I mean, one of the it's an excellent question. I imagine we can talk maybe an hour on this. I'll try for a short answer here and say that yes, capitalism has an amazing ability to be able to self-correct, and many a crisis that comes up, it's able to assimilate the crisis and actually turn it into a means of opportunity. At the same time, I think we are increasingly coming up against various environmental limits that kind of neoclassical economic models are having trouble with, and so you have folk like geographer Jason Moore, who actually discusses that maybe we are actually coming up to the end of cheap ecology. And the thing that neoliberalism has been able to lean on for so long, you know, cheap land, cheap labor, and all that, has been increasingly coming up against pressures that aren't being assimilated in a way that they have previously. Can the economy be used to fix the food system such that it continues on and helps the economy? I think they're doing in the various ways that the agribusiness folk are thinking things through. They are trying to deal with that. I think the example that I had brought up was the notion that buying up all the organic food companies. So they are doing their best to try to get a grip on what is something that is shifting out from underneath them. The other way they're doing internationally is to buy up huge tracts of land elsewhere. 60% of the remaining so-called virgin farmland is in Africa. And so there's a mad rush there to pick up as much of the land that's left over as possible and turn it into export agriculture. And it's been done in a very interesting way. It's been done in a way that says, we need to take the land out from underneath African smallholders in order to save the world. So, I mean, it used to be that, okay, well, if we have an ecological disaster that industrial agriculture is, we can do some greenwashing and we could say, okay, we messed up there, but look what we're doing here. And we're doing wonderful things with water over here or children over there and such. But now they're presenting the very model by which they destroy land and people's livelihoods as the means by which to save the world. So the argument is, okay, we need to be able to produce food in a much more ecologically friendly way, and we need to be able to produce more food per hectare than what smallholders do, which is in some sense kind of obscene and absurd because much of the food on this planet is actually produced by smallholders, like 70%. So, you know, they are feeding themselves quite fine, thank you. But what they're talking about is the people who depend on market food. And they're appealing to them on this green like ideology, and they will use GMOs, for instance, whatever you think about them, whatever the health effects. I mean, I'm kind of agnostic on that, but I do see GMOs being used as a kind of a Trojan horse by which a particular social model of production is moved into countries abroad. So we're going to say this GMO is to be better in terms of producing food per hectare in Africa. But what they're after actually is merely a means by which to expropriate the land. Mm-hmm. And so it's the colonialists again, wearing their pith helmet, but they've all painted the pith helmet green. So in other words, I would say yes, the economic system is deeply embroiled and involved, and there's a lot of for lack of a better term, innovation in thinking of ways to maneuver through a difficult political environment and continue agribusiness on its way, even if it means, in essence, removing the capacity to build food to grow food for much of the world.
Yeah. So, sorry, Rob, I know that we're up against the clock, and I have two questions. Sure. One of the big diseases that's in the news right now is Zika. And you've spoken already about how actually influenza is far worse than it used to be, and its main the main mm-hmm. pressure behind it was a political one, influenza was a political problem that's now been dealt with because everyone's bored of it. Mm-hmm. Zika is something that seems to be temporarily attracting the attention of our fickle media, and mm-hmm. I wonder if there's a story that you can tell us briefly about what's really going on with Zika. We hear so many conspiracy mm-hmm. theories. What's the real story there?
Well, my take on it is that Zika, which came to Latin America from Polynesia, is basically it's very much the same thing going on. I mean, it's confronted by a neoliberalized agriculture and forest, and you have pressures that are. The mosquitoes actually transmit the virus, and the mosquito that is best able to transmit the virus is one that does well in areas that have been deforested and also urbanized areas. So, and urbanized areas that have basically have lost their capacity or have removed their capacity to remove standing waters, pools of water that are the means by which mosquitoes reproduce. And so on one end, as you have deforestation cuts into the forest, driven by kind of a capital from abroad, then by logging, by mining, by monoculture agriculture, it produces an environment in which mosquitoes that are best able to transmit Zika are able to spread best. On the other end here, you have structural adjustment that removes the much of the public health and animal health system that had previously been able to keep many of the flaviviruses like dengue and yellow fever from actually spreading as more than they usually do. So my take on it is that, and this is one of the things I begin to revisit from one outbreak to the next, is that in my view, there's a common thread that goes through them, and that is that when you make these profound changes to the landscape, most of the pathogens are going to die out because their hosts are going to die out. Like if you deforest an area, almost all the megafauna and even the small animals are going to die. On the other hand, there are hosts that are able to do quite well under these new circumstances. So in the case of influenza, we've replaced, the wild birds are actually behaviorally plastic. And so previously they were in wetlands. They didn't just die out when we destroyed all the wetlands. They then moved to farms where they feed on the food and increases the interface between wild birds and the livestock. When it comes to Ebola, you turn the West African forest into monoculture, let's say, for palm oil, then the bats who carry Ebola, they don't just die out when the forest is gone. They actually are migrating to the palm oil monoculture because they don't have any predators there. There's ample place to fly and lots of food. That increases the interface between bats and humans. And you look at Zika, and we've got the mosquito. Destroy the forest, and you select against mosquitoes that are more forest-oriented and four species of mosquito that are for more deforested areas and for urban areas. That increases the size of the mosquito populations and increases the interface between the mosquitoes and the humans. And so there's the common threat. The capacity. If you divorce economy from ecology merely as a means of kind of monetizing the forest in such a way that somebody can make a huge buck, then you end up crumbling the mechanisms by which the forest has typically been able to keep the worst of pathogens from emerging beyond merely hitting a village or two.
Well, that's an amazing story of how, in fact, the secret ingredient of pathogens is capitalism. And you've mentioned in the book this idea of imperial epizoology, which mm-hmm. is just a fantastic phrase. And I wonder if you could give us an example of what imperial epizoology is and why we should care.
Well, it goes back to some of the previous answers. I mean, it really gets to what is driving the emergence of many of these pathogens. And, obviously, there's a virus, and we can look at it under the microscope. Or we could look at the animal reservoir, whether it be a bat or a mosquito. And we should look at those dynamics for sure. I mean, we should definitely look at the molecular aspects. We should look at the ecological aspects. The humans involved, cutting into the forest, yes, most definitely. And this was where a lot of the eco-health people will stop. They'll stop at the notion that deforestation is happening, is causing these things. And the thing is, you have to actually, well, what is driving the deforestation? Where is the money coming from to be able to do that? And in some ways, you know, the way I characterize it in the book is that, well, you know what, maybe we need to look at the sources of capital. And if you look at places like New York or London or Hong Kong, which are prime sources of capital driving deforestation around the world, then maybe we need to characterize those places as being hot spots of disease in their own right. And so we got to move away from just looking at the, let's say, Brazil, or looking at Liberia as being where the action is in terms of the epidemiology, and that look at epidemiologies as kind of relational, that things happening in one part of the world affect the other. And if we're in the business of painting our pith helmets green and going into Africa and taking their land, there's an imperial aspect to it that goes deep into the history of the relationships of peoples around the world. And so, in essence, we're kind of, again, revisiting means and modes of dominating peoples around the world. And the diseases that stem out, that arise out of the mechanisms by which we attempt to dominate other people are hand in glove. The imperial aspirations we have, whether however we dress it up, whether it's the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, whether it's Monsanto, GMO, whatever main mechanisms by which we try to steal land from other people, that becomes the mechanism by which many of these new diseases are emerging. And this is why I call it imperial epiziology.
You know, I know we've gone over, so I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, because this was really great.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. I appreciate all the work that you guys are doing, and continue on, please.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too. Take care.
Bye.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Rob Wallace is the author of Big Farms Make Big Flu: Dispatches on Infectious Disease, Agribusiness, and the Nature of Science. It's out now. We spoke with him via NPR Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You've been listening to The Secret Ingredient with Raj Patel, Tom Philpott, and me, Rebecca McEnroy. You can find more information about this show, also an archive of all of our past shows, and links to more information at thesecretingredient.org. On our next episode, the secret ingredient will be breast milk, and we'll talk with writer Kimberly Seals Allers about her book, The Big Letdown: How Medicine, Big Business, and Feminism Undermine Breastfeeding. Also, make sure you never miss an episode. Subscribe to us on iTunes. The Secret Ingredient is engineered by David Alvarez and produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas.